That's tough to lose. La, 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 la. There's some noise. You don't hear it though, do you?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Hi there. Welcome to season 13 of She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time.
This season's theme is all things residential, and we will be talking about ladies who are involved in residential projects.
As always, we're not experts. We're just sharing stories about the information that we find as friends having a fun conversation. If you find an error, send us an email and we will all continue learning.
This week, we will be talking about Elizabeth Coit, a pioneering architect and advocate for public and affordable housing. I'm Jessica Rogers, and I'm sending well wishes to our friend Stacy and baby Carbloom, based out of Miami, Florida.
Woo! And I'm Lizzie Rahr. Yay! Congrats to Stacy and John from San Francisco.
I'm Nurjeri Rivas, excited for the new Carbloom baby from Houston, Texas.
Yeah. All right. Our story begins in Winchester, Massachusetts. Elizabeth Coit was born on September 7th, 1892. Folks called her Betty. Her father, Robert, was an architect who designed weekend homes for the wealthy. Her mother, Eliza, was a homemaker who passed away when Betty was only 13 years old.
Oh, that's so tough to lose your mom that young. Poor Betty.
That's terrible.
Betty, along with her sister Dorothy, would be encouraged by her papa to attend a liberal arts college. After briefly attending Radcliffe College, Betty would transfer to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts in 1912, and then finally landed at MIT to receive her Bachelor of Science degree in architecture in 1919.
College hopping up in here. But good for you, Betty, for getting your degree. I'm assuming that Dad had some influence in her career choice.
You know it.
When Betty graduated, she worked for her dad for a little while, but then moved to New York City and worked as a drafter at the firm Grosvenor Atterbury and quickly became a design assistant.
That's cool.
Yeah, get in there, Betty.
Yeah. What was cool about the firm Grosvenor Atterbury was that they were considered to be pioneers in low-cost housing and were known for their standardized construction shown in the Forest Hill Gardens.
Now that you mention it, his story is kind of interesting. He studied at Yale University and architecture at Columbia University. Then he went to work for McKean, Mead & White. So you know he must have been exposed to wealthy people in all those places. He started his career, similar to Elizabeth's dad, doing weekend homes for the rich. But then he got a commission to do Forest Hills Gardens. And there he developed standardized construction methods using precast concrete panels with everything fabricated off-site and then assembled on-site by crane. This was really innovative for the time. There were even articles in the New York Times in the late 20s, early 30s, talking about how his method could cut 20% to 50% of construction costs. It was a big deal.
Wow, that's really awesome. It sounds like a great place for Betty to learn and work about the industry and different ways and strategies, you know, than just standard construction.
Yeah. So Betty worked at the firm for about 3 years and then took a year-long vacation to Paris to study ceramics and art history at the College of France. And when she came back, she still had her job at Grosvenor. I don't know what kind of PTO plan they got, but I want in. Ladies, if you could be like Betty and take a sabbatical to study or do whatever, what would you do or what would you study?
What? This is so, so jealous.
Is this real? This real life? What a dream. I wonder how she negotiated that with Grosvenor.
Yeah.
Right?
If I could take a sabbatical from work to do something for me, I would really lean into expanding the reach of this podcast. I would reach out to IAWA, the Beverly Willis Foundation, Kate Regev, serious researchers, and ask for advice on how to grow the research efforts of the show. Then reach out to organizations and create connections and see where that goes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
sabbatical.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah, that sounds admirable.
Yeah.
Sabbatical is, I mean, that's the dream. I would 100% travel the world. I would get to stay longer in certain spots, visit friends and family, maybe do an intensive learning another language or something. That's what I would do.
We gotta like justify what we're doing, right? Because it's a sabbatical study.
Right. It's not like I wanna travel.
It's not vacation.
Is it? Sabbatical could just be rest and restoring. I am being restored by travel.
Oh.
I do like the idea of doing a sabbatical just to focus on podcast stuff. That would be kind of cool. I think I would just travel everywhere, kind of like Lizzie, though. But maybe I would actually get my MBA.
That's not a sabbatical. That's a...
Yeah, it would be an intensive. But it would be an MBA at an international school or something. I don't know. Point is, I wouldn't be where I am now. I'd be out, okay? Just out. The office would not be able to even email me. Sorry, no cell reception. Bye.
Getting the MBA would be a close second for me. I've considered that, but for real.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a friend who just completed a program in Spain, Jessica.
Oh.
So that could be something we do. And he said that it was affordable.
That's what I've heard too. That's why I've considered it. It's just the time away. But if I have a sabbatical, then...
Let's get the sabbatical. And then...
Let's figure out how we can convince our bosses. Okay. Betty returns to New York from her travels in 1926, back at her job at Grosvenor Atterbury, but only to work part-time while studying to become licensed and then eventually to establish her own firm.
Yeah, get it, Elizabeth!
That's right, Betty.
Yeah, I wonder if she told her boss that, like, I'm back, but I'm only going to work part-time because I want to become licensed and I also plan to leave your firm to start my own.
I don't know. I just don't think that's how the conversation went.
I don't think so, but you don't know. Maybe Grosvenor was very like, you too, you boo. I'm just here for the ride. I don't know. Anyway.
That's nice.
In 1930, Betty finally gets her firm, and it's up and popping, okay? She was still in New York designing homes. Most of her clients were mostly women. She did a lot of remodels in New York and New Jersey, and she also did restaurants and offices.
I love that she's getting that work.
Yeah.
That's great. Businesswoman, firm owner, architect Betty has arrived.
Okay, so... One of her notable houses that she did was a cabin for herself and her companion, Eleanor Duncan, in Croton Heights, New York.
She had a girlfriend?
Yeah, tell us more about Eleanor. But also, are there pics of this cabin?
There are pics of the cabin. I guess you would have to check out our show notes for it.
Oh.
As far as her partner, my sources just say companion. They didn't say lover.
Did you expect them to say lover?
Lover. Lover girl.
Lesbian relationship.
Okay. It's vague.
Well, they were together, okay?
Okay.
Unknown.
Or maybe I just read it and didn't think much to it. But the resource that I did use for this was the Pioneering Woman website. So that's where a lot of my resources stem from. Now, I can tell you about this cabin, though, because apparently this log cabin house won an honorable mention in the Better Homes in American Small House Architectural Competition.
Wow. That competition name is long and specific, but also kind of catchy.
Yeah.
Congrats, Elizabeth, for the honorable mention.
Yeah. And then what's also important to note, because like I was like, where the heck is Croton Heights? So it's north of White Plains, New York, and it's like near Connecticut.
Okay, gotcha.
Now, Betty was interested in affordable housing. She did a lot of research and wrote/published a lot of articles on the subject. Some of her research included her close observation of low-income housing in Europe. In 1935, Betty would go to Belgium, Holland, Austria, and Germany.
I wonder if her interest began while working with Grosvenor and how much of an influence he would have been for her. And I'm glad that she got to travel and explore how other countries were doing it too.
Yeah, I can see how that would be super helpful to see how other places were addressing this. But that's also a good point about working with Grosvenor and that being a big influence as well.
Yeah, especially when you think about his like methods of construction costs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Homegirl was publishing writing. She wrote and published for the Radcliffe Quarterly, her alma mater. And Homegirl was obsessed with affordable housing and low-income housing. She would say that in Europe, Europeans saw decent housing as a public necessity. But as much as she admired what the Europeans were doing, she was critical of their designs that were interesting. Like, for example, in Brussels, she noticed an impressive apartment building with rows and rows of windows, but all the curtains were closed. There wasn't much community interaction, maybe. Or what she says, they required the strongest cooperative instinct to keep all the glass clean and warm in the winter.
Hmm. You know, I always forget about this very important maintenance point. And that's such an interesting observation about how it felt like the architecture didn't lend itself to a sense of openness or community.
Yeah. Unfortunately, cool design sometimes isn't the most functional or maintainable.
Yeah. It reminds me of the struggles that the Smithsons had, Allison and Peter. They were episode 113. They created well-intentioned community houses, but the sharp corners became dangerous and the glass windows that they had were poorly insulated.
Yeah. The amount of things architects need to think about and respond to sometimes feels endless to me.
Yeah, it can. Also, Villa Savoye comes to mind too with this. Wasn't that also one of those houses that like the clients were like, it's kind of terrible living here or something like that? I can't remember.
I don't remember, but I totally see it.
Also remember randomly in a lecture that, remember that lady that would come and visit our lectures? And we had like big or some big firm like present their project. And it was like this glass skyscraper. And the question was, how do you clean the windows? And I think as a student, you're like, oh my God, this lady is so weird. Like, why would you ask that question? But now, as an adult, I totally get it. How do you clean?
But like, real talk.
Yeah.
Real talk.
Like, how? So Betty, when she was in Germany, she was noticing these small balconies. In her mind, how are people going to hang laundry or have flower pots? She says, quote, a balcony is not a living space in these congested dwelling quarters, but rather an architectonic grace note proving the designer's savoir-faire and looking particularly jolly in the come-on plaster model displayed under a sun lamp.
What?
She had thoughts.
Yeah, tell us how you really feel, Betty.
Like, the balcony is a place to look pretty for 30 seconds while you take a photo?
I guess so. I mean, yeah.
It's a hot box for pictures, but you can't use it. You can't. Maybe I need to see pictures, because are these balconies like small spaces where you just stand and look?
Yeah, well, some of the, you know how they do that sometimes where it's like just a small space for you to be able to like step outside or.
Yeah.
I mean, she's sort of not wrong, but sometimes it's like visually nice to see that or it makes you feel like you have the ability to go outside. But.
Well, when I lived in apartments, I liked having a balcony and I would go out there.
But your balcony was somewhat bigger compared to these German ones.
Right. Yeah. It was big enough that you could sit there. Like.
Yeah. You had plants, I remember. Didn't you have like one or two pots? According to Betty, they didn't even have anything. Well, with all of these critiques that she had, Betty would write them, and it would actually lead Betty to join the National Public Housing Conference, or the NPHC, in New York City. This group, led by figures like Mary Kingsbury Simcovich and Edith Elmer Wood, brought together educated women committed to improving urban life for working class families. The NPHC took a unique approach to housing reform, pushing for government intervention while also emphasizing grassroots activism. They rejected the then popular idea that working class people needed more reform, challenging the classist biases often embedded in housing philanthropy. Betty's involvement with the NPHC profoundly shaped her own philosophy on public housing, making her an advocate for designs that truly served residents' needs.
Wow, that's so great. I can see how there would be a lot of classism, and probably still is, in thought and conversation around public housing.
Totally. I can see how a lot of public housing design would be based on what people think is the most efficient for maximizing units, or assumptions on what's needed rather than really getting to learn from potential residents what they actually need.
Yeah.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
Okay, so in 1937, Betty won the A.I. Langley Fellowship for Housing Research. She would use that fellowship to travel across the United States to visit different types of housing. It is said that she saw 120 cooperatives, housing projects, projects built by insurance companies, like probably the ones that Beverly Lorraine Green did. She visited defense housing and early housing authority developments.
I really like how much she's researching existing housing developments to inform her designs.
That's so neat. Jessica, do you know what the A.I.A. Langley Fellowship is?
From what I can recall, it looks like it's a research grant. So Homegirl was using it to her advantage. I'm not quite sure how much money they get, but she was able to use that for traveling. So that's cool.
I'm going to look into that.
Yeah. Normally, these fellowships last a year, but Betty was able to apply and win the fellowship for an additional year. And her main interests were evaluating the economic methods of designing and constructing low-cost housing.
I love this. And I can't wait to hear what she did with the information that she gathered.
Yes. When she visited these places, she obviously looked at construction from an architect's perspective, noting experimental construction. But she also spoke with the tenants. She asked them about their needs and wants in housing.
Yes, this.
Great. I wonder what they responded.
Yes. So at the end of her fellowship, Betty wrote two very important reports. The first being the one I think she is most known for, called Notes on the Design and Construction of Dwelling Units for the Lower Income Family. And then the second was published in Architectural Record called Housing from the Tenant's Viewpoint.
Those both sound really interesting.
I'm more interested in reading the second one.
Well, and it sounds like they were both well-received or well-publicized.
Yes and yes. Because, of course, since it's like this is coming at the tail end of her fellowship with the research grant that she got. So it's well publicized from both parts. And on her point of view of the tenant's perspective, I'm assuming that they were also well received just for being insightful and doing that groundwork. But let's talk a little bit more about these because they are interesting. Betty's main note was that the tenants use their kitchen for things that they ought to use their living room for. Somewhat like today, right? Like kitchens were used for so many things now and back then. They were the place the kids played, laundry got done, meals were eaten, whereas the living rooms would most likely be turned into an extra bedroom, especially in low-income households. So here we're talking about like the formal living room today, you know?
Well, yeah, because they got to maximize the space based on their needs and priorities.
For sure. And I mean, it's use the space you have to your advantage. And it also makes sense because if mom is working on laundry and cooking, then she probably wants the kids nearby or at least have eyes on them, right? So they'd be playing in that same space. Plus, if you need more sleeping space, like if multi-generational situation, you'll prioritize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was no open floor concept back then.
Right, right.
I think Betty's main observation through her travel was that a lot of architects and planners at the time assumed middle-class lifestyles were the quote-unquote right way to live and tried to push those habits onto working-class families. Betty thought housing should fit the way people actually lived, not force them to change to fit someone else's idea for better.
You tell them, Betty.
Agreed.
So this takes us up to the early 1940s, specifically 1942.
Oh no, we've entered World War II territory.
Yeah. So Betty would become the technical standards editor for the Federal Public Housing Authority's publication, Public Housing Design in Washington, D.C. There, Betty was developing design standards for low-income housing.
Ooh, this sounds like a very important job.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Betty is making stuff happen.
Yes, and mind you, Betty still has her firm and is designing for private clients. But she is also doing her work as an editor and working for the Federal Public Housing Authority.
Of course she is.
Lord have mercy.
All right, so in 1948, Betty would become the principal project planner for the New York City Housing Authority, NYCHA, where she was responsible for overseeing architectural contracts, making sure that the housing met the needs of the tenants.
Casual.
Just when you think she can't get more important, she goes and does that.
Right?
Yeah.
So she was able to put her thoughts into design herself when she designed things like the Bronx River houses in 1951. She incorporated things like adding the dining nook in the kitchen, making a separate living room and larger bedrooms.
I'm glad that she was able to take this research and put it into practice in design, right?
Yeah.
All right. Are y'all ready to play some bingo? Because I'm about to drop some names.
Ooh, okay. I will prepare myself.
But we didn't make a card.
Ooh. Play it in your mind, girl. Because it's going to be a lot of names.
It's metaphorical bingo.
All right. So Betty's thoughts on public housing were very much a bottom-up approach to urban planning, which went against Jane Jacobs' thoughts on her top-down planning methods that she mentioned in her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. Now, Betty was also buddy-buddy with Catherine Bauer. They were constantly writing letters to each other.
Yes! I spoke about Catherine on episode 24. She was really great. I like Catherine a lot. Glad Catherine and Betty are friends and impacting change together. This is great.
Yeah, I'm loving these connections with past ladies. And it's interesting, though, the difference in the approach from Jane. Did they butt heads on it or just different approaches?
From what I read, it's funny. They don't gossip like they used to. Because I feel like in today's world, they would have gossiped about it. Like, ooh, they hated each other. So I think that they were mostly having just different approaches, like friendly debates, you know? Because Betty was on the side of the tenant. She dreamt of creating apartments that gave the tenants freedom to create the spaces that they wanted, suggesting that maybe units would have unbolted partitions that allowed flexibility between spaces.
They need some Schroeder House action.
Too true. Call Han.
Yeah, I immediately thought of Han. Betty would retire in 1962 from the Housing Authority, but only to work on other organizations like the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, or NAHRO. she felt really strong about state funding for low-income housing.
Just going from one thing to the next, you know?
Yeah.
Because, of course, she can't really retire. I bet she felt like there was still so much more work to do, even at 70.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At the NAHRO, she wrote/edited their newsletter, where she showcased positive examples of urban planning. She commissioned J. Max Bond Jr. to write an article about the Articles Renewal Committee in Harlem.
So J. Max Bond was a famous Black architect that was critical of Harlem architecture and the criticism of low-income housing as it pertained to Black and low-income communities.
Yes. And Homegirl also talked about housing in Latin America, too. Chiquita was talking about housing worldwide.
Oh, of course she was. I wonder where in Latin America she was focusing on.
I think she included things like the favelas in Brazil, for one. And I'm trying to think of where else, but I know that that was mentioned in one of my sources. In the year 1970, Betty, being close to 80, was appointed by the mayor, John Lindsay, to the Landmark Preservation Committee. This role would let Betty travel to landmarks that were being considered for preservation.
This feels like a new mission.
Yeah, she's pivoting now to a whole new career.
Yeah. At 80, y'all.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, my grandpa is 84. You know what he's doing? Not that. Anyways. Because of Betty, places like Carnegie Hall, Grand Central Station, and Radio City Music Hall are preserved today.
Amazing.
No way. That really is so amazing. Thank you so much, Betty.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. So, in a retirement home in Amherst, Massachusetts, at 94, Betty would pass away on April 2nd, 1987.
Betty, what a lady. Ugh, she really fought for housing that worked for residents, and I really love that. So I'm really glad that we learned about her.
Mm-hmm.
What a life she led. She was so involved in so much positive change and so passionate about people and housing. Absolutely great.
Betty was extraordinary, and the world knew it. When she passed, there were several obituaries written in her honor. This quote I found gave a great example of this. The Times wrote that her major contribution to the architecture of low-income housing was her insistence that the point of view of working-class residents should be the primary concern in planning public housing.
Yes, what a concept to design for people, for the user.
Yeah, it seems obvious, and yet we're still talking about it.
Today. Y'all, Betty flew planes and she did watercolor? I didn't even talk about that. She often said that flying planes was better than driving because it gave her better views of housing developments.
Flew planes?
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting point of view, pun intended. Brumps. Okay, but way to casually throw in there that Betty was a pilot. Just one more amazing thing. Don't mind me. Nothing to see here. Just flying planes.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, maybe she took Carol barnstorming sometime.
Yeah, she went barnstorming, and then she was like, you check out them trees, I'm gonna look at these housing developments.
I'll fly you around, Carol, pick out your trees.
Oh, and not only did she do that, but Betty was an advocate for getting more women in the profession, too. She would point out the stats that were from the AIA, specifically from the New York chapter. She would write to her alma mater at MIT, where she broke down what being an architect was all about, from the day-to-day demands to the incredible sense of fulfillment the work could bring. She ended her piece with a powerful and inspiring message. Quote, I think no profession open to women compares with architecture in the extent and variety of satisfaction it offers to those who practice it. The field is wide. Architecture is at once the work of nations, the record of religious and social aspirations, and the most intimate of arts. And for good or ill, immortality is ours. We are like a city set on a hill. We cannot be hid. Town and countryside bear witness to our art or lack of it. Even though the tower we plan to reach in heaven never did rend the stars apart, its scattered architects made themselves a babbling name, which is only another way of saying that opportunities are unlimited, end quote. Betty was adamant that gender shouldn't hold anyone back from entering the field of architecture. For her, it wasn't just about designing buildings. It was about creating spaces that could generally improve everyday life, which I think it sets the theme of our season of what we hope to do with all things residential, you know?
Yeah, I love this. I also just really appreciate that she wanted to promote women in the profession and didn't see herself as just an architect, which so many of our ladies and ladies in the profession at the time did, which we've talked about before, and I understand why they felt that way. But I also really like that she emphasizes how broad the profession is and that there's a place for all different pursuits within architecture, which means it isn't limited by gender or background.
Hear, hear.
Cheers to that.
All right. So now we have reached the second part of our episode, the caryatid. A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or a pillar to support the structure of a Greek-style building. In each episode, we choose a caryatid, a woman who is working today, furthering the profession through their work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode. So without further ado, drumroll please. Catherine Hernandez! All right, so Catherine is originally from South Central LA. She's got a really strong background in community work, policy, and how those things show up in the built environment, which reminded me of Betty, because she runs her own architecture studio where she focuses on designing affordable housing and community spaces that actually serve people, especially in neighborhoods that usually get overlooked. Her whole approach is about using design to help drive real change, social, economic, and physical, in communities that need it the most.
This sounds amazing and right up Betty's alley.
Mm-hmm. OMG, that really does sound amazing. So Jessica, she's originally from South Central LA. Is that where she practices today?
Yes, she does.
Wow.
She's really passionate about housing justice and works with all kinds of groups around the South Central or Southern California area, from tenant unions to people pushing for better policy. Everything she does is rooted in making sure communities are healthier, more equitable, and truly represented in the design process. She also helps lead work with design as protest, which is all about holding the design and architecture world accountable for the harm it's caused to Black communities and pushing it to do better.
Oh, I love this. It sounds like she is really trying to better design for the users and the community that her housing will be serving, which was just like what Betty was doing. And like we said before, unfortunately, is not always the case.
Also, Design as Protest sounds like a great name for a podcast.
Ooh, yeah.
It sounds really interesting. We should reach out to her for a future charrette. I want to learn more about everything she's doing and highlight that work.
Yeah.
Agreed. That would be a great charrette. I think Design as Protest, I feel like our girl Melissa Daniels would know what that is, because I think she might have had guests from that group. And I want to say Brian C. Lee Jr. is a part of that group as well. He's the current NOMA president. So on top of everything that Catherine does, she spends time teaching and mentoring young people, running workshops, summer camps, and portfolio reviews, helping them see how they can use design to make a difference where they live.
She's so passionate about the community. She finds lots of ways to give back.
Of course. I mean, you can't just do one thing, though.
You know it.
No.
No. Just like our girl, you gotta have multiple things going on.
That's right.
All right. Before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links to all of our resources on this episode, as well as pictures of projects we've talked about.
We hope you enjoyed learning about today's lady and caryatid along with our banter, and that you are inspired to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you've enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your neighbors, your family, tell them all. Tell him to give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify and write us a review. This will all help us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about these amazing ladies with us.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website at shebuildspodcast.com/donate, or you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/shebuildspodcast. You can also find links to all these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram or Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X, formerly known as Twitter, at shebuildspod. Until then,
see ya!
Bye!
Adios!